And the first case has already been heard by the Supreme Court of the United States very recently. It's the Hobby Lobby case, in which the Green families, who are the principal owners of the Hobby Lobby chain, are challenging the mandates on the grounds that they violate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That was a piece of federal legislation put into place in the early to mid-1990s in the aftermath of a very controversial Supreme Court decision called Employment Division against Smith, coming up out of Oregon, in which the court essentially did away with what at that point had been the traditional standards of constitutional review for religious liberty claims, and that is the standard that says when a law or executive action impinges negatively on someone's religious freedom, the government has the obligation to show that the law is necessary and is narrowly tailored to advance a compelling state interest. That's the highest standard known in our law. And in the absence of such a showing, the claimant must be given a conduct exemption from the law in question. When the court essentially abandoned that standard, Congress, by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in both houses, enacted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to restore the standard, and President Clinton signed it into law. So it is pursuant to that law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is known as RFRA, and the standard that it reestablishes, that that the court's going to be deciding the Hobby Lobby case.
And you would agree with the Hobby Lobby folks that it is a violation of religious freedom if they are compelled, being opposed to abortion, to, for example, provide payment for that to an employee.
Yeah, the government's got to meet the standard. And it's hard for me, having read the transcript of the oral argument before the Supreme Court, it's hard for me to see how the government can meet the burden there, and that's in part, as a couple of the justices pointed out, because the Obama administration has granted waivers generally to businesses and unions and others from the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And if the waivers can be granted for non-religious freedom-based reasons, it's hard to see how they could then constitute, nevertheless, a compelling state interest, and it's hard for the state to make out that argument, the state here being the government, the federal government in this case.
And of course, the other debate about religious freedom currently in this country hinges in part on if someone has to serve a gay person in their business and they believe that that violates their religious tenets, then they would rather not do that.
I think that the real cases that arise have mainly to do with whether a claimant who does not, cannot in conscience participate in, by contributing services to, or professional artistic talents to, a same-sex blessing ceremony or wedding ceremony, can nevertheless be compelled by the course of power of the state to participate in that way. So I don't think that the standard cases, at least the cases I'm familiar with, don't involve someone walking into a business and ordering an ice cream cone and being told, well, we can't serve you.
And do you agree that that's a violation of religious freedom?
I agree that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act should apply there just as it applies everywhere else. Now, in any particular case, the application of the act, the consequences of applying the act, will depend on some contingent circumstances. Whether, in fact, there is a compelling state interest. Some of the considerations that will be taken into account, for example, will be whether people seeking to have their event served have the effective alternative of other providers. If they don't, then the case for rejecting the religious freedom claim is going to be stronger than if they do.
At what point, Dr. George, do civil rights trump religious freedom, if ever? The usual example is, for example, if a person says their religious beliefs include white supremacy or white separatism and they don't want to serve black people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the standard is clear. It's a compelling state interest and least restrictive or intrusive means of prosecuting that interest, and that would apply under RFRA in all cases. And I think that the compelling state interest in ending racial discrimination, where what you had was a system, a comprehensive system of racial subordination and exploitation, reducing an entire race of people to a condition of servitude, a race of people who had previously been under official servitude in a system of slavery. That's a very powerful consideration. So I don't think that religious freedom considerations are going to weigh very heavily when it comes to racial discrimination or something similar to that.
Mm-hmm. But you would argue that there's not the same compelling state interest for someone's sexual orientation.
Well, I think what you have in the case of the nature of marriage and sexual ethics is a reasonable debate in this country among people of goodwill, and I think it's wrong for anybody on any side to deny that. Nobody on either side is the equivalent of a bigot or a racist or a hater. We should stop calling each other names or assuming that there's no reasonable argument on one side or the other. There are some cases, like racial discrimination, which are straight out pure, unambiguous bigotry. There are other issues on which reasonable people of goodwill can and do disagree. So I don't think we should analogize our differences with our fellow citizens over a vast range of things, including the nature of marriage and the requirements of sexual morality, to racial bigotry. And I stress again, it shouldn't be done on either side. I also think that no one should be, for example, fired from a job for any advocacy on either side by anyone of an issue like this on which reasonable people of goodwill can and do disagree.
I mean, if I could just interrupt, because I want to clarify for our listeners your position. If there is a business person who says, I'm not going to serve black people, you would find that compelling state interest would say they should not practice that. But if someone who owned a business said, I do not want to serve a gay couple, that would be, in your mind, not a compelling state interest that they should do that.
Let's be clear on what we're talking about here. It's not a question of whether someone who comes into a shop should be served, whether they are same-sex partners or whether they are people who oppose same-sex relationships. The real question is, can someone be compelled with the force of law to participate in an event to which they have reasonable moral objections, like a wedding or some other kind of a ceremony?
Okay, well, let's use that example. So if a wedding photographer said, I'm not going to take photographs of a wedding between an African-American couple, you would say the compelling state interest is they should be compelled to do that. But if it was a gay couple, you would say not.
I don't think that you can draw an analogy between the debate over marriage and sexual relationships and the question of racial bigotry. I do not think that they're equivalent. That's correct.
Let's do now talk about your position on gay marriage.
It's not what I'm coming to Montana to talk about, of course. I'm coming to Montana to talk about religious freedom. Now, I'm happy to talk about marriage if that's what you want to talk about, but it's actually not what I'm in Montana to talk about.
I would like to talk about it. I think it's of interest to our listeners, don't you?
I suspect. It's an NPR station, isn't it?
Yep, I think it'd be of interest to anyone. I mean, it's a current huge debate, certainly. In your position, Dr. George, is that marriage is only between a man and a woman.
One of each.
You have been quoted as saying that legalizing same-sex marriage would be a disaster for children.
I think what is a disaster for children is transforming marriage, and this transformation began in the 1960s. Transforming marriage from a conjugal partnership to a form of romantic companionship or domestic partnership in which the having and rearing of children is merely incidental, where the real nature of the relationship being recognized has to do with affection, emotion, the romantic bond. I don't think the state has any particular interest in our romantic bonds just as such, any more than it has any interest in our ordinary friendships. What it has an interest in is an institution which historically, and I think rightly, has been understood as one that brings together a man and woman as husband and wife to be father and mother to children who are born of that union, giving to offspring the advantage of being brought up in the marital bond, the committed bond of mother and father, the mother and father whose union brought them into being. Now, of course, things happen. Not everything goes well. Families break down. People die. Parents die. Arrangements have to be made where the best interest of children is the fundamental concern. But the institution of marriage, historically and I think correctly, has as its ground of legal recognition its importance in bonding parents to their children and giving children the advantage of, to the extent possible, whenever possible, in the maximum number of cases, being brought up in the bond of the mother and father that whose union brought them into being.
So a couple, a man and a woman, who did not want to have children but wanted to be legally married, you would say the state has no interest in that marriage either?
The state has an interest in the institution of marriage. The state has an interest in the institution of marriage. But insofar as their bond is merely a romantic bond, it doesn't have an interest in the bond. It does have an interest in the institution.
I just have time for one final question for you, Dr. George, and this is a little bit off topic, but not totally. And that is, what do you think of Pope Francis, who appears to be trying to steer Catholics like yourself away from focusing on issues like gay marriage and abortion and back to social justice issues like helping the poor? What do you think of him and his sort of admonitions about that recently?
Gosh, I think Pope Francis is wonderful, and I love his focus on social justice and helping the poor. And I agree with him that among the central issues of social justice are issues of the sanctity of human life and the dignity of marriage as the conjugal union of husband and wife that is the greatest anti-poverty program that's ever been created. The Pope has in no way backed away either from his convictions or the Church's teachings on the sanctity of life or on the dignity and nature of marriage. So I say amen, brother. I'm with him 100%. I think he's offering great leadership here, and everybody on the left and on the right should listen to both sides of what he says. Nothing would please me more than if my friends on the left as well as my friends on the right would perceive the wisdom in what Pope Francis is saying and embrace his positions wholeheartedly.
Well, I've been speaking with Princeton University professor and author Robert P. George. Dr. George, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.